Okay, good evening, everybody. For those who have been here for all 4 weeks, congratulations on finishing the semester. For those who only came for Rabbi Ganak and didn't come for me, I'm not offended, because this is a special shiur, so we're really glad that you are here, as well as he. For anyone that wants to take the final, it'll be next Monday evening. Irving will be here, so you can join him as well. And a happy birthday to David Revis as well. So, very special. We are glad you're here celebrating your birthday with Torah the way it is supposed to be. The Torah tells us that when Yaakov Avinu finds out that Yosef is still alive and the family needs to move down to Mitzrayim to survive, so the Torah tells us that Yaakov prepares the family to leave, but he sends Yehuda out in front. Yehuda shalach lefanav lehoros lefanav goshna. The Torah says he sent Yehuda ahead of him lehoros. So lehoros is a very ambiguous term, and it can mean a lot of different things. On the practical level, what lehoros means is that they needed a leader in the family to help make the arrangement. Someone needed to work with the local government to figure out how many houses they were going to need, and someone was going to have to decide who lived in the upstairs apartments and the downstairs apartments. Someone needed to take care of the family, and it was a source of comfort for Yaakov that he could send his most responsible, who have become his most responsible son, the one that emerged as a leader, Yehuda, to protect the family. Chazal tell us, Lehoros smacks of teaching, it smacks of Torah. And he sent Yehuda down to prepare the family, to build a base medrash, but whatever that means, it means to prepare for the spiritual challenges of Yaakov's family and the Jewish people having to leave Eretz Yisrael and start their life in Mitzrayim. Is it a contradiction in terms to say that the first version is Lehoros is a practical need and Lehoros might, and on the other hand, it means something spiritual? I don't think so. In a certain sense, the two interpretations work perfectly together. Because who better to prepare spiritually than someone that has the abilities to navigate the practical challenges of the new environment? And the same is true in the reverse. If you have someone who has the practical capabilities to know what it takes to build a new home, so that's great, but if he doesn't have the spiritual sensibility to make sure that it's the right nurturing Jewish environment, so then the family's going to falter in a spiritual sense as well. Yehuda becomes the perfect role model for what leadership is in this duality of his ability to think practically, but also to think spiritually about the well-being of the Jewish people. So when Rabbi Ganak graciously agreed to join us here this evening, so I thought of that that metaphor of Yehuda's life and Yehuda's role specifically in Mitzrayim. You know, many people know Rabbi Ganak from his long career at Shomrei Emunah in Englewood, and I think he is known internationally for his role at the Orthodox Union. My experience with Rabbi Ganak was the opposite. There was a small group of guys in Smicha that used to learn, I think it's still Sunday mornings, it certainly was Sunday mornings in my day, that had the opportunity to learn Yoredeya with him, to learn the sugyos of Kashrus and the Misora of Rav Soloveitchik and the Halacha L'maisa with a world expert in such a unique setting and an environment. When you hear about someone who has done so much for the Jewish people and who does so much internationally to make, in a practical way, wherever you go, you can find OU products that could be coated with all the ingenuity and all of the skills that they use. So you think about one model, and then you meet the person and you sit across the table from them, and they still teach Yoredeya with the Shulchan Aruch open, the way it's always been taught in the purest of ways. You see the second dimension of Yehuda's leadership. And it was a source of inspiration for us learning with him then, and it continues to be a source of inspiration, I think, for all of his Talmidim, when they listen to him and they hear his Shiurim and they purchase the OU products with that famous symbol on it. Just to know, the origins of what's going on behind the scenes and the kind of spirit that is infused in that practical effort to make our country and the international community benefit from the opportunity to have kosher food, as we've seen throughout this semester, in a way that did not exist throughout our history. So I couldn't think of a more perfect way for us to conclude this semester, and it is a tremendous honor for me personally to welcome Rabbi Ganak and to thank him for coming and to introduce him this evening.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you, Rabbi Zirkin, for your gracious introduction. So I'm going to speak about some contemporary issues in Kashrus and just analyze them from the perspective of halacha. And some of them I think will be interesting to you because they're at least one of them could be really revolutionize the way we think about food. So I'm going to start with that one. And some of you may know about this. There was an article about this about a year and a half ago about the $300,000 hamburger. Did anybody remember see that article? It's about a genetically derived meat. You can call it, the industry calls it clean meat, and there are a lot of startups that are working on it. What they do is obviously there are different technologies how to do it. I'm going to give one simple way. They take stem cells from an animal, and they propagate it in a laboratory, and it grows and grows and grows. So now that $300,000 hamburger is now down to about $600, and in a few years, there's no question that it'll be, the cost the same as a regular hamburger. There are enormous advantages in terms of this kind of development. Just one extraordinary statistic: the amount of CO2 produced by cattle in the United States, the carbon footprint, is larger than all the CO2 of cars and trucks in America. So, on an environmental level, that itself is a huge gain. Of course, some people don't believe in global warming, but for those who are not in denial, the issue about CO2 is an important environmental issue. But for us in kosher, the question is, what is the status of this meat, if we call it meat? Is it meat? Is it fleishik? And is it kosher? Well, if it's kosher, what we would have to do is, and this is not difficult to do, those initial stem cells that they're working with, they can just take it from a slaughtered animal. So then, offhand, everything that's propagated from that would be kosher. We might not even need melicha, salting, because they're only taking the stem cells. There'd be no blood cells, integrated into this. So now the question is, if let's assume we were able to supervise this, what's the status of this, let's call it synthetic meat? Is it meat? Is it fleishik? Is it pav? So that is by no means trivial. So I'm just going to give you the argument why it should be pav, which I myself happen to believe. But I included, one of the poskim for the OU is the Moshe Weiss, very renowned Talmid Chacham in Eretz Yisrael. He wrote a tshuva which I included. He thought the opposite. The consequence for us, whether it's fleishik or pav, is not so profound. But there would be, there would obviously one difference would be: can you make a cheeseburger with it, right? It still would be issues of maris ayin, even if because the Gemara says it's called Shulchan Aruch that, for example, you can't take if you take meat and cook it with almond milk, people might think that you're cooking it with regular milk, so you have to put almonds on the table so people will know that it's really almond milk, not real milk. So you can obviate this problem about Marasayan, at least on the local there, just put a sign up that this is, this kind of meat, whatever they're ultimately going to call it. So I wanted to, in today's parsha, follow the rabbi's advice. I always quote the Kotzke. The Kotzke said that every speaker should follow three rules. He should always speak about the parsha, tell the truth, and be brief. Mm-hmm. And then the Kotzke said, I'll tell you the truth, I forgot what parsha it is this morning. So I'm going to just follow the Kutzker's admonition. On page 2 in the handouts, the Pesachei Tshuva has a discussion about an animal. He quotes a shalah about an animal that was magically created from the Sefer Yetzirah. Let's just read to give a shalah. kasa de behema shenivrei sayde seva yitzira, kamo de matzina begmara dabra agla tilsa, b'chol erev Shabbos, mutula ochlu ba'odo chai, v'zeh hayamash, he says, if an animal was created through magic, that doesn't really have the status of an animal, and you don't have to shecht it. You can even eat it live, he says, but at least you don't have to shecht it. And he suggests that's the story of this past parsha, the most dramatic parsha in the Torah, with the brothers in Vayeshev. We know Rashi says one of the reasons the brothers resented Yosef was that he would tattle on them. And he's told their father, Yaakov, that they were eating Avim and Achai. And they really weren't eating Avim and Achai. What they had was eating was something synthetic that they created from the Sefer Yetzirah, and therefore the Avim and Achai would be mutter. Ki Yosef sav shehaya behema gemura, right? So it's like, this is the Shalah's interpretation. V'nira de mikama kam osel ochla b'lo shchita midrabanan mishumaris ayin. Nonetheless, with the issue that I spoke about before, which would have consequences in our case, you still have to do shchita because of maris ayin. Okay. So he quotes. Quotes from the Parsha Strachim, which is the Mishnah Melech. Maybe it does require shchita, but. So, of course, this the Pesach Tshuva is quoting an Agada. You know, there's a famous Tshuva. It's actually one of the first Tshuvas in the Chacham Tzvi. Has a Tshuva if you create a golem, right? Like the Maram, you know, Replags, the famous stories of the golem. Actually, the story of the golem, we think it's, you know, an ancient story. The legend of the golem is 20th century. First written in the Yiddish in the 20th century, and then we think it goes back, you know, to the 17th century, but it's not. But anyhow, he has a shaila about if you make a golem, can you be mitzvah to a minion? So now this meat, right? It's really being artificially grown outside, right? So it doesn't have the status of meat. So the argument that it doesn't is because essentially is they're taking the genetic template of the meat, and they're, you know, it's not that same genetic template that's in the hamburger that you're eating necessarily. They're just using that to create the put all the amino acids, whatever that they have to put together to create similar, you know, site-like properties. So I would have thought, and especially based on this Pesach Tshuva, that it has a status of Pav. This also is relevant. I just want to mention, I have Yahrzeit for my father, Zichron Levracha, this the last day of Hanukkah, and it's his 50th Yahrzeit. So I'm dedicating this class in his memory. But there's a very famous Vort from Chaim Brisker, which is very well known. Rav Zevin quotes it in the Sefer. But, you know, there's a famous question asked by the Beis Yosef. Why do we celebrate 8 days of Hanukkah, commemorating the Nes? After all, the first night wasn't the Nes, because they had enough oil for the first night. It's only the other days that it's a Nes. And there are literally hundreds of answers given to this question.
I just want to quickly mention, I'm not an expert on this particular stem cell panel manufacturing, but you mentioned that it doesn't create blood, but stem cells in general could create any organ. So even though the specific process they showed you didn't generate blood, I don't think you can give a blanket hashgacha. You would still need to supervise the periodic process, because...
Well, we're going to have to supervise the whole thing from beginning to end, otherwise it'll be bosish and salmon and iron,
right,
and we don't know that they...
Theoretically, different process done by a different company.
It could be. But just the stem cells themselves, as they're generating, this is what the company told us, the scientists there, would not, you would require separate, requirement to create blood with it. So the blood doesn't come along automatically. But, I mean, there are lots of different technologies being discussed, and it's not necessarily for meat. They told me now that one of the companies can produce it from feather. You know, it's the technology is growing literally day by day as the research continues.
Is it possible from Sinai at its part? Or that's a unique thing?
Right. So if it's not Boston, then it's not Boston. It's not
Ivan.
Right. And it would be a very big nafka mina for us. Also, a difference would be how many do you need two chosomos? Because for meat, if you send it, it has to be double sealed. If it's not meat, maybe it doesn't have to be double sealed. In fact, it wouldn't have to be double sealed. So, so it's an important issue for us. And I included Rav Osher Weiss's tshuva. You know, I'd spoken to him before. He quoted these Pesachim tshuvas and others. I was going to tell you this from Chaim's, because we have to link this to Chanukah. It's Chanukah tomorrow. So Chaim's answer to Beis Yosef is, he said like this, that obviously the nes of Chanukah was that this cruse of oil somehow had enough capacity to stay lit for 8 days. But it wasn't that it kept propagating new oil. Because he says, if it was new oil, that would be Shemen Shel Nes. And that's not called Shemen Zayis. And for the Menorah, needs Shemen Zayis. So that's also relevant to what we're talking about. So that's a huge difference in how, if this happens, just in general how we eat. So just for the kosher consumer, and I assume it's not just hamburgers that they can make. Once they could propagate this and make it, you know, they can make, you know, steaks and whatever. But of course, you know, the research is down the line, but it's coming. I was recently at the fancy food show they have at a Javits Center each year, and they had different lectures. And one of the things that they were talking about was, as the world population grows, how are we going to feed the world population, especially if as the population grows, and also with global warming, there's going to be much, much less arable land that you can cultivate. So what scientists are talking about, they're concerned about this, but one of the things they said is they're looking for sources of protein. Now, the protein that we get from meat, right, from slaughtering animals, is one of the most inefficient ways of generating food. Because I don't remember the exact amount right now, but how much grain do you need to produce, you know, a pound of meat? It's multiples and multiples of that. So what they were talking about, these, you know, the lecture to find that they're going to look for other sources. And interesting, one of the sources they're looking towards in the future is insects. Now we're going to have a hard time with that, you know, unless we become Temanim, and you know, there are kosher locusts and so on, grasshoppers, but you know, all kinds of insects. I opt for the hamburger, you know, the artificial meat, but it's something that's important for us to think about. But for the kosher consumer, I just want to point out there's an economic consideration as well, because when you think about kosher meat, kosher meat is much more expensive than non-kosher meat, as we know. But there are several reasons why it's more expensive. First of all, there's an opportunity cost of producing kosher, namely that a kosher slaughterhouse runs at one third the rate of a non-kosher, because you have to slaughter it and you have to run it slow enough so you can do the shchit and so on, slow up the thing. So, but you still have to have the same infrastructure and all the the economics of people in the plant. So that increases the cost in terms of the fixed cost associated with the plant. But the other thing is, the kosher operation, at least in terms of meat, not poultry, but we only get a small portion of that which of the animal that's slaughtered, because if you think about it, first of all, we don't take half the animal. That's called the chelak ha'charayim, the hindquarters, because the hindquarters, there's many communities in Europe had a meaning not to take the hindquarters for two reasons. First of all, the hindquarters had the chelev, the forbidden fat, which is a serious prohibition in Issacharis, and also it has the sciatic nerve, which you have to cut out. That's the Gidon Usher. And so we don't get involved with that at all. The whole hindquarters we just sell to the treif. So that's already 50% you've lost. I always quote, I think it was my hero is Abraham Lincoln. So Abraham Lincoln, I think it was General Pope, who was one of the least successful generals in the Civil War. I think it was Pope or Buckley said he used to sign his dispatches to Lincoln, you know, general whatever, whose headquarters are in the saddle. And Lincoln, upon reading it, said the trouble with him is that his headquarters are where his hindquarters ought to be. So the hindquarters, the whole hindquarters, we're not taking. Then we only get, of the kosher, usually the kosher rate is something in the range 30-40%. So it means we're only getting 15-20% of the animal. But if you think about it, if we have the synthetic thing and they're growing it from this stem cells, and we'll make sure it's, you know, it's kosher stem cells to start with, we will get a 100% kosher rate. So in terms of the economics of kosher meat, it'll be a tremendous boon. So this development, you know, it's still something we have to talk about. I thought it was poverty. You see, Rav Moshe Weiss thought it was not. We spoke to another place again. I saw Mordechai Gross also thought it was meat, but Rav Shechter thought also, Herschel Shechter thought he thought it would be pav. We're going to go l'chumra, of course, in this at the end. But the development itself is just so exciting because, in terms of, you know, what it impact on the economy, I meant in terms of the cost of kosher meat, on the environment, and these the kind of things that they're doing in terms of genetics, we don't even know down the line some of the things, but we see it all the time in terms of food technology.
If it's freezing, are you still going to have Giranasha problems and things like that?
No, they're not. Yeah, they're taking just for, they're not taking the Giranasha. They're going to take
the whole thing's going to be kosher.
The whole thing will be kosher, 100% kosher.
Right. So those economic benefits will still hold even if you treat it like flesh.
Yeah, no, I'm assuming it's flesh. I'm just saying you're getting 100% kosher rate. You know, to get 100% kosher or close to that, you got to be Hebrew national. You know, mm-hmm. But it's quite remarkable. And the impact, I think, will be significant. Okay, that's the first part of it. Should I questions or? Okay, so I'll talk about just one other thing, which you might have read about in the paper, which we're dealing with a lot now, and that is, did any of you read about, in Israel was a big story, about the brekel. The brekel is a kind of a chicken, which originally some people invested in, because the halacha by poultry is, as you know, a kosher animal is determined if it has, you know, chews its cud and has split hooves. But birds, the Torah doesn't mention any simonim for the birds. So the Torah only tells us there are 24 non-kosher birds, right? Everything else is kosher. The trouble is we don't 100% know what those 24 are. So therefore, the Ramah says that you should only eat birds if we have a besorah on them. So one of the problems, of course, is how do we eat, and there's a lot of discussion about this, how do we eat turkey? After all, turkey's a New World bird. And there's I think I printed the Tshuva in the Tshiva, the Meshiv Dava, and he relates to that. How do we eat birds? How do we eat turkey? Right? So he says, you know, at the end, we don't need the Masorah. The Gemara has other ways of identifying kosher birds, if it's not a predatory bird, it's not a doyrus, and so on. And Mishas Sadchak, we're relying on that. But we try to have a Masorah on birds. And so this became a big issue. This new bird, which is not so new, which is the Brekel is a town in Belgium. And it came from there, and those who first introduced it, and it was a Satmar Chosr, a very fine person who invested a lot of money, millions of dollars, to, you know, grow the Brekel, and because he thought that it had a purer Masorah. So, and then, as you can imagine, there was a whole dispute about it, and Moshe Sternbach and Moshe Landa and Eretz Yisrael said it's Usa and so on, and so it before he got the business going, and then of course the Nissen Karelitz and others thought that it was good. So we've been involved in speaking to companies about the companies that, there are only two companies in the United States that really grow or breed, you know, poultry. So we arranged with the Satmar Rebbe, He asked me to come to his office. I'm a labor. I'm friendly with both brothers. Not such a trivial statement. But anyhow, we went down to Avigen. We're talking about, it sounds like a shidduch, but we're talking about the yichas of these different birds. And so the first thing that's interesting is about the Masorah of birds. So I want to, and that's something we've been still dealing quite a bit with. Some now just try to introduce to get back to the old time religion. What was the bird that the Sama Rebbe ate, go back to Bereshis Bara. It's not so obvious, but they just introduced this week, they're shechting upstate, it's called Plymouth Rock, which they think is a pure breed, may not be quite as pure as they think. So this tshuva in the Meshev Dover from the Netziv says, and it's based on the Chassam Sofer, not sure if he quotes the Chassam Sofer, but the Chassam Sofer said, that the Gemara says in Choyris that a kosher animal you can't breed a kosher and non-kosher species. They won't be able to have a child, and therefore, if you see one chicken, you see one animal is breeding from another, one is a kosher species, you know that it's a kosher, and it has a child, right, has an offspring, you know that it's a kosher species, and that's what the Chassam Sofer said. He thinks probably that applies to birds and baits and eggs as well. So that's one of the things we've said, that, when he was asked about the brekel, we didn't want to get into it, it was too political an issue, but it's almost certainly kosher because they're breeding it with other kosher species of birds. So according to that tshuva Chassam Sofer, and which the Netziv confirms, so it should be okay. But it's a big issue. So I just wanted to mention that this issue actually applies, according to some, the Chaya Adam, and the Chochmas Adam says that it's not only birds. He claims, based on a reading in a shach, I had meant to give you that shach, but it looks like I did it. But anyhow, it depends how you read a shach. The shach says that for animals also, you should have a mesorah. So this became, that's how the Chochmas Adam was the Mechutna of the Vilna Gaon, about the Chai Adam, was a dayan in Vilna, in the 18th century. So the Prima Godim disagrees, and he says that's not what the Shach means. What the Shach means is, if you're not sure if something is a Chaya or a Behema, right, so then you need a Mesorah, because it's not so easy to tell the difference between a Chaya or a Behema. And some of them, for example, buffalo, the word buffalo, by the way, appears in Shulchan Aruch, believe it or not, in Hilchas Kisi Adam, because it's a question with a buffalo, whether it's the same bison that's roaming, in the West, but that word buffalo appears, what's a chaya behema, and therefore, because the halacha is a chaya, like a deer and so on, you have to cover the blood after you shech the kisi adam. A behema, a cow, or a bull, you don't have to cover the blood. So is it a chaya, is it a behema? It's not always so obvious to tell what the simonim are. That's what the Prima Gom says, that's what the shach is talking about. However, the chazan ish, there was a kind of cattle that was introduced it's called zebu. It's indigenous, I think, originally to South America, but you have it also in India, and it looks a little different. It has like a hump on its back, and that kind of cattle, the Chazon Ish claimed it wasn't kosher, and at the time of the establishment of that state of Israel in 1948, so Rav Herzog permitted it because it had split hooves and it chewed its cud, and the Chazon Ish asked it at the time. Recently, this issue re-emerged, and Rav Eliyashiv said he wanted to be machmel like the Chazon Ish. Afterwards, he backed off a little, but then he said, at least for the people who live in Bnei Brak, where the Chazon Ish live, they should be machmer, but they shouldn't throw anything. If they already bought it, they shouldn't throw it out. So it was only lechumra. So one of the interesting things about this, unbeknownst to them, is that when Israel got the cows for milking, they didn't do so well, they got them from Holland, they didn't do so well in the Israeli climate, so they crossbred it with zebu, and almost all of them are crossbred. So if you really think that there's a problem with the zebu, then we have to get involved in the issue about crossbreeding animals. What would be, you know, would it be, would it affect its status or not? Okay, so that's just an interesting consequence. And I want to just mention, I just put out a sefer, so I had this Shtickel Torah, which I'm going to share with you. How come we don't find, according to this Shach and the Chachmas Adam, why don't we find that to eat fish, you need a mesava? Actually, the Dakar Tshuva asked that question. So I wanted to tell you why I thought, even according to the Chachmas Adam, who has a chumma by what? By not only by birds, but also by cattle, that you have to have mesava, why it might not apply to fish? Because, you know, there's a question, the simonim that we have, Mafeshes Pashas and Malagera, that could choose to sort, is that what determines that it's kosher? That's what that makes it kosher? Or that's just a proof? If you look, you know, if you look on the chart, if it has these qualities, you know it's a kosher species. But that's not what makes it kosher. In the yeshiva parlance, we say, is it a seba, right? Is that the reason, or it's just a raya? So that's a question. That's the whole discussion about that. I don't know if anybody here is old enough here to remember, but do you remember when there was this story? They thought, this goes back about 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, that they found a pig that had split hooves and chewed its cud. They found that, they said this was in, I think in Australia, they claimed they had some in the outback. At the end, it wasn't true. It was baloney. But so there was a lot of discussion about that. Well, if it did, is it revolved around, you know, this question? But if we assume that by animals, it's just a proof, not that it's the thing that it create makes it kosher, not the goyim. By fish, I think absolutely. What makes something kosher by fish? So it has two criteria. What are the two? Scales and fins, right? So there, for sure, I think that those are the things that make it kosher. It's not just a proof that this is a kosher species. Because the Gemara says that everything that has scales has fins. So then why the Gemara asks, why mention the fins at all? Why does the Torah mention it at all? After all, if it has scales, it'll automatically have fins, and that's sufficient. So Gemara says, lahag del Torah la'adiva. So what does that mean? So I think what the Gemara means like this. If it was just purely a proof, then the fins are completely irrelevant. What you really have to see are the scales. Why mention the fins at all? But if the Torah is telling you that these are the things that make the fish kosher, right? So then even though indeed in terms of identifying it, all you have to know is the scales, but the Torah is mentioning it because that means the Hagdol Torah Adir, because the thing that in fact makes it kosher is what? Is the fins. Is the fins as well as the scales. And therefore, mesorah, you know, additional proof, you have a tradition about it, that's if you don't have, if the simonim are just approved, so we can expand it in terms of animals as well. But if it's the thing that's goyim the kashrus, so then the mesorah is irrelevant. That's what I was going to suggest. I have some other things I was going to talk about, but I think maybe I'll stop here if anybody has any questions. But any OU policies or...
So if the OU pastor, the synthetic meat is...
it looks that unless it'll be some, you know, some very, very poor meat made from mushrooms or something, you know, fake, right?
And what's the theory that it should be pleshex?
So, it, like Rav Asher Weiss told me, you know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and says it has all the qualities of a meat, so that's called meat. I was bothered by another thing, you know. If you say it's meat, they're propagating in the laboratory like this, laboratory, you know, ultimately an industrial environment, where's the shechita for this meat? So maybe it doesn't need, because you had the original things was geschachten, right? So maybe it doesn't require shechita. So maybe it's like a bempkur. Bempkur is an animal, you slaughtered the mother, and the mother was pregnant at the time it gave birth, so that embryo doesn't require shechita. The shechita of the mother related already to the embryo, even though this embryo continues growing and so on, it's alive, right? So, and then you can eat that meat. But something to think about.
And going to take the stem cells from a live animal?
No, it doesn't. It don't have to take it from a live animal. No.
Which communities permitted and which communities did not permit melanocortins in Europe?
So, right. So I'm not sure which you know. I'm not sure it was. Some did, some didn't, and I'm not sure for you know geographically or whether Galsianas or this. But it's an interesting question because actually we had this question. We asked Rav Elyashiv about this because we had for a while a slaughter of venison in Goshen, New York, and the question was, what about the hindquarters of the deer? Could we sell that? So Rabbi Belsky asked Rav Elyashiv about this, and he thought, said, look, the general minhag in America is that we don't use the hindquarters, but it's not such a minhag kavu. It's not like the European cities that went back hundreds of years. So he said, Rabbi Belsky Shiloh was the minhag of not eating hindquarters because of the chelev, because of the isa karis, or was it because of the gid anasha? Well, the difference is deer, because by a chaya, the chelev is mutter, there is no isa chelev, but there's still an isa gid anasha. So depending on that, so Rav Yoshev said that he thought that the reason was because of the chelev, because it's an isa karis, so it would not apply to deer, especially in America, we don't really have a strong minhag, you know, per se. So Rabbi Belsky, in his own ingenious way, after Rabbi Yoshev, he figured, he went to different surgeons, and he figured out, and he, you know, which, using different scalpels, and how to actually do the nika on the hindquarters, on the, you know, not on the gid anasha, so that you didn't lose the best cuts of the meat, you know, the sirloin and so on.
How active is the OU in China in terms of what they are? Sometimes you see cookies. I don't know if the OU actually does a headshot on anything made in China, but if they do, how much quality control? And there are things out saying that the quality in China is not what it is here or even in Europe. And also, if you have like plastic forks and plastic spoons, most of this stuff is made in China. Is that necessary to have a hekshir? I've seen some where they do have a hekshir from, I'm not sure if it's you or not, from plastic utensils. Is that necessary to have, and if so, how do you determine that?
That's a good question. Actually, today, I was telling Mr. Goldstein, I came this morning, I had a meeting at the OK Labs, OK Corral, you know. And that was that discussion was through different kosher agencies that come in, LBD from England, and we're talking about China. So, and we tell what I said at that meeting. I said, listen, if I had my druthers, I wouldn't be in China at all. We're there because American companies are there, and we have no alternative because they're getting primarily ingredients from China. Most of the ingredients that we get are you know, relatively innocuous. We call them number one ingredients, kosher from any source. But in China, things that are kosher from any source can end up being not kosher also. They're quite remarkable. So there are issues. As you know, there was a very big issue, what was it called, melanin? The enzyme or the amino acid in the milk that were they
lactose.
Lactose is the milk sugar. But anyhow, which they didn't have, and you know, children died, and this was because the quality control throughout China at that time, at least, was extremely poor. It's better now because they executed some of those people. No, that's what really happened. Chinese government decided we're gonna, but even after the stamping down, I promise you, it's not what we have here in the United States. So, in terms of the quality control, we try to be careful what kind of ingredients we have. We have about 450 plants under the OU in China. There are thousands more from other supervisions, so that we accept. But you know, but we have people in China all the time, and we check these plants.
So when you say you're talking about food, you talk about utensils.
No, I'm talking about food, but mainly ingredients. There aren't so many. There are some, but it's not so much end products that are coming from China to the OU. It's mainly ingredients. And there's also an important flavor company that has a plant in China, Firmenich, which is one of the largest flavor companies in the world. But when dealing with flavor companies, they have very high standards.
So there's no way for a consumer to know that these ingredients are from China, right? I mean, if you look at a box of ingredients, it doesn't tell you.
Of course not.
Food coloring from China.
Right.
So there's no way that a person would know.
No.
Because the final.
Why do you want to try to exclude any ingredients from China?
Well, I just have a lot of doubts about the general quality control.
But there's no way, you know. Ultimately, you know, in terms of some of these issues, you know, that's beyond the OU's ability. You know, that we rely on the USDA and the FDA and so on to set the standards for things that are important.
But you're saying there's not a final product that comes out of China?
I don't say there are none. I said, but most of the stuff that's coming from China, you know, 90-something% are ingredients that are being used by American companies.
So in other words, it's brought back here and then the American companies use it to make the finished product?
Correct.
Now how about utensils? Does that have to have a mixture?
Usually not.
Because I've seen some where it does have. So.
You know, companies ask for hechsher and things that don't necessarily need them, that up here halacha might be mutter, maybe there's a lechatchil of a lechatchil based on a taz. But you know, let me ask you, you know, companies are selling water, right? You know, if you take the water, except for the copepods, out of your tap in New York City, it's very high grade water. And still, you know, a lot of people are buying, and those are marketing considerations.
Poland Spring has your Hechsher on it, right?
So that's what I'm saying. Poland Spring does have a Hechsher, because the company asked for the Hechsher. And, you know, it even without the Hechsher, it's likely that it's kosher. Sometimes there are occasions when we found water that's not kosher. For example, it was pasteurized in a plant that they were also pasteurizing grape juice or things like that. So it's conceptually possible, but, you know, that's why I don't think, though, you said you can't use, the only one you could use is, you know, the one with an OU.
So a person, if they buy a bottle of water, or they're at a place where they give out the water, you don't have to worry if it doesn't have a Hechsher on it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So you mentioned that, like, you seem to be in favor, at least, like, on a practical level, synthetic meat, and that other rabbis are also. But do you think in general, like, assuming, like, in a hypothetical world where, like, you know, this was available now, the OU had the ability, or some other kashrut agency had the ability to monitor it and suggest changes that were feasible, that, like, that this stuff would be, in the end of the day, be kosher and accepted by, you know, mainstream Orthodox Judaism?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, as I said, you know, this is going to be, I mean, I don't know if you saw in the paper recently, but Bill Gates invested in one of these companies $75 million. So it's you know, a lot of people investing this, and it's not just one. There is really startups working on this. So it's really down, it's not so far down the pike. It's a matter of a few years, I think. I mean, I don't know for sure exactly, but it's something that's coming.
A few people, I asked in advance if anyone had questions that they wanted to submit. And a few people asked me about OU dairy products versus dairy equipment and the evolution of that. Could you talk a little bit about where it used to be versus where it is today and how for the consumer to kind of process
right.
Items are actually dairy?
So what the OU's policy has been, to a large degree is, except we're breaking it day by day, is that we used to list things that were made on dairy equipment as dairy. Oh, I mean, we don't write dairy, we write OUD. And we didn't make a distinction between dairy equipment and dairy. We did that for several reasons. First of all, to know that there's no residue of dairy and it's only dairy equipment is another level of supervision that, you know, we didn't want to necessarily engage in. And also, we thought it was confusing for the consumer, because the difference between dairy equipment and dairy is only for, you know, a lumdisha crowd like this. In other words, what's the difference? The difference is that if it's dairy equipment, you can eat, the halacha is like this, you're not allowed to eat, as you know, milchix after fleishix, but if it's only something that was produced with dairy equipment, that's called a nat bar nat, so you're not allowed to eat it immediately together with meat, but you're allowed to eat it immediately after. You don't have to wait, you know, let's say 6 hours, 3 hours, whatever you wait between. So let's say somebody wanted to bake a cake, and it was dairy equipment, right? Just in your house, it was a milchix pot, right? So you would be allowed to eat that cake immediately as part of that meal, but not together. You couldn't take a bite of meat and eat it together. You couldn't put it on the plate with the meat. Let's say it was a kugel or something. So we listed as dairy also, even though the OU is not necessarily Chol V'Sol, we have Chol V'Sol products as well. But, you know, there are a lot of people very mocked about Chol V'Sol. So we want people to know if it's, because they then think that it's not Heter, they think it may be Surabola without the specifics, and therefore they wouldn't be allowed to eat it. So we want to let them know which things are dairy, could it be Chol V'Sol, not Chol V'Sol. So, but we've gotten, and some companies, I mean, the most asked question, Kasha, what is the most, who knows, what is the most asked question, kosher question today, or the last few years actually? What?
Are Oreos dairy?
100%, that's it. Are Oreos, that is the most asked question, right? And the answer is that Oreos cookies, they make some that are dairy, but the standard Oreos cookie, most of them were made in Chicago in a huge plant, are actually PAV. They haven't used that equipment for dairy for years and years. This could change, but this is what it's been for. So I'm not, there are some, you know, Oreos cookies that, you know, the double triplet or whatever, but the standard Oreos cookies are, and that's the most, and so, but it says OUD on the cookies. Well, it says OUD because, you know, Oreos, which is owned by Nabisco and Kraft, doesn't want to change. You know, it wants to. They won't have the flexibility that if they change the formula, they don't have to change their wrappings and that's why they leave it as OUD. So that's the and so. But
are you postulating that now you can cook with the original Oreos in PAR?
You could, no, but that's something that could change. So you know you have to be on top of it to make sure if it changes. But that is as I said the most asked question. And again, it's only the standard Oreos, and only here in the United States. And the Oreos outside the United States are maybe made with dairy. What we've changed a little bit is because, especially things for kids, you know, that what do you call them? You know, like the silk, you know, the so that really is PAV. It's just made on it may be made on dairy equipment, so we don't want people to think it's Milchix. So we write there. We change it to, you know, maybe made on dairy equipment. Now we start writing DE.
You just told us all that Oreos are PAR, even though they're labeled dairy, so that Nabisco has the flexibility to change what they do. What if next week they change what they do? You just told us all in the room that it's PAR. We're gonna treat Oreos as PAR next week.
Right. So
you're not going to be back here next week. So
maybe
right. I shouldn't ask a question.
Right. So that's a good question. But I mean, what we're going to do if it does change, right, and becomes really dairy, these ones, we're going to have, you know, that's why we tell consumers, you know, right now it's dairy. It could change. You know, that was my introduction. It could change. We would communicate it through putting it on our web and so on. But that's the kind of thing that you should check. And we do have this information on our web.
Is it a safe bet when items have any ingredients, they use it for allergy reasons, and they say if they have eggs and wheat and milk in them, if it says allergy warnings and has eggs and meat, but it does not say that it has milk, is that a fair bet that it's the OUD powder?
And you don't see dairy? It's not 100% guaranteed, but it's likely.
It's a very product-specific question, but when you see a product that changes from being PAR to being dairy, but none of the ingredients change, specifics. What is the cause for that? The kalem, or I mentioned the specific because I know there's a lot of people outside, you know, big kosher Jewish cities. Trader Joe's chocolate chips went from PAR to Milchix.
Right.
Yeah. And I know that's a big problem in more the West Coast.
Right.
Could you speak to that specific product?
I think it. I don't remember right now about the Trader Joe's, but I remember everybody talking about it. So I think it's likely that in that case it's just the equipment. So and therefore it would remain a not by not in terms of using it, in terms of, you know, what I just spoke about before.
Are you saying if you go to Shalva Shudas and you have like rice and maybe potato salad or whatever that was made in a meat pot or a meat bowl, whatever the case is, you can go out for pizza an hour later, and it's okay, right?
Right. Right.
It's only if there was actually meat in this stuff would that be a
correct.
6 hours.
Right.
You talk about when a mashgiach is required, in the sense that if Orthodox kosher catering comes from the Jewish center to cater a meal, we require a mashgiach. If you go to these big companies, they're operating on Shabbos, they're operating on cooking, baking on that, there's no mashgiach there, and yet it's still kosher. Why does an Orthodox kosher caterer need a mashgiach, yet a big company operating on Pesach and Shabbos doesn't?
Right. So, in terms of, there are several issues. One issue that, you know, which we take care of in the plant, assuming that it requires it, I'll just give you a few issues. So one is Bishul Akum, right? The food has to be cooked if it's a high quality food, which means the definition is when it says Ola Shulchan Malachim will be served at a king's table. But that means to say that it's not just junk, I wouldn't say junk food, but you know, it's something that you'd serve at a, you know, catered event or something like that. So first of all, you have to, assuming that you have non-Jewish work or you know, chefs and so on, you have to make sure that you've taken care of the issue of Bishul. You have to make sure you've taken care of, if it's meat that they're serving, that there's not a problem of Bosheshin Nisalim and Ayim, which we spoke about before, that the meat was always, you know, we know where the meat came from, it was supervised throughout. I'll just say, you know, in terms of my own experience at the OU, we have, you know, a bunch of restaurants and caterers, primarily in the New York area, not around the country. And I have a whole staff handling those. They are much, much more difficult than handling plants. Because large plants, let's say Nabisco or whatever the plant will be, you know, they're getting their, where their suppliers are. They're running the same thing day after day. We send people in on it, you know, on it, you know, whatever, unannounced to the schedule. So let's say if it's something like Nabisco, that he's probably coming once, he's coming monthly. But it's much, much easier than dealing with caterers or restaurants in the New York area. Even if, I'm not saying if they're doing anything felonious, I'm just saying just the possibilities of things that can get mixed up.
What is the OU's policy about going after new, I guess, products, but like businesses in the city? So for instance, all of my non-Jewish colleagues seem to think that Bread's Bakery, which is a chain, is kosher because I think the owner is Israeli. And you know, they're like, oh, it's all kosher, they don't sell food. I don't know if that's true, but they're saying, why isn't it kosher? And I'm thinking, maybe I should call the OU and tell them to go in there and see if you could make it kosher.
Right.
Is that your policy, that you solicit the business, or you wait for others to come to you?
Generally speaking, we don't solicit business. But not as, it used to be it was a matter of policy that we don't. We didn't. That's not the policy any longer. We do. We go to trade shows and things like that. We don't call companies, you know, blind and say, most of the business that we get, so to speak, is because we have different companies and companies apply. And if we have companies that are under us, large companies, they have ingredients and they have to get them from different places. And those ingredients have to be, you know, every component in the product has to be supervised. But so now in your case, it wouldn't be so obvious or easy to supervise or make sure that this is kosher for several reasons. First of all, it's a retail operation. We have to supervise all the different stores. It's probably open on Shabbos. As a matter of policy, we don't use, you know, retail operations. This is, right, these are stores you're talking about, right?
It's a bakery, right.
So we won't, right, it's a chain. So it's open Shabbos. We wouldn't handle it. It's probably, there's a big issue over Pesach because it's an Israeli owning it. So it's Chomesh Lev Pesach. And since it's Jewish owned, you'd have to take challah. I mean, we could figure out how to do it. So it wouldn't be a trivial thing to do. It would come back to what I said before. You know, 98% of the business of the OU and the revenue of the OU comes from large manufacturing facilities. The food service is a tiny part, but it's a big headache.
If you have a part of the product, like a vegan product, and you want to certify it, let's say, as par versus dairy equipment, would you charge more based on whether it's dairy equipment or it's par?
No, I mean.
Why is there a distinction between a retail operation and a factory, whatever, in terms of Shabbos? if they're both Jewish owned.
Right.
Facilities.
Right. So because just to be halacha, you know, if it's a large manufacturing facility, so it becomes, it's also for the owner maybe, but it's mutl acherim either immediately after Shabbos or b'chdei shi'asa, the amount of time that it would take to bake this or produce it, you know. So, and in terms of a retail operation, it's not so obvious that you can't do it. A lot of vadim, for example, have local bagel stores that they give supervision to. This is just the OU's policy, you know, just to be above board and so on. But
for those factories that are open on Shabbos that are under your supervision, you know, you may have random spot checks. Do you make sure to have occasional spot checks on Shabbos?
So some of them we actually do.
Okay.
But I don't say that that's the general rule. But you know, there are factories that are working, you know, 24/7. So we just had one just now with figuring out how to have a mashgiach be there on Shabbos as well. But that's not the general, you know. I don't want to make it sound like we're doing it on a regular basis.
Yeah, because it seems to me if they know
that you're not coming Shabbos,
to
right?
Show up on Shabbos, they
right.
One day a week they
right.
Can do what they want.
Right. I think maybe I'll stop here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Anything or doing anything except the fruit, except the vegetables, and that's not getting mixed with anything from the seafood, the deli. So that you hold to that without the hashgacha? I'm asking you.
Okay.
But like, if you have a place that has washed vegetables,
you say, what would you only? You only trust things that can be supervised.
Okay. You don't supervise that.
Right.
So what happened with the chips at Trader Joe's?
My mom's doing this.
I asked you specifically about the Trader Joe's. I was in Hawaii, and I was at the Chabad dinner, and the Rebbetzin told me, I was like, it's such a problem. And that was like the only way to get part of chips in Hawaii was through Trader Joe's and out of camp.
Right. So, I mean,
what happened?
Again, I don't, this may be a shock. There are many ingredients. I don't know all of them by heart.
Okay.
But if you send me an email, I can check it and send it back.
I'm very interested to know about that. There was one other thing I was going to ask you. I'll let it go because I can't remember what it was.
I was in 60. No, I graduated in 69.
Someone named Gannett gave us a stock ticket. It was in a stock market. I had a stock called Equimar. Anyway, we didn't make any money. It went up like crazy. Somebody was in the stock market.
Yeah, last.
Excellent. Sounds familiar. Maybe it was me. But I wasn't in the stock market.
Because
somebody
cousin,
probably told
my
me.
My cousin was in the.
So your cousin was your.
Your cousin was my first cousin.
Okay.
Our mothers were sisters.
Uh-huh.
So he told me about it.
So
I remember these.
But the other ones like quite like collapsed. So you got to hear them.
Nice listening to the ones. You're enjoying your sister.
Okay, so my mom was supposed to myself with the weird opposite Trader Joe's to get it from like New Zealand or whatever. Usually, if he doesn't know, at least he knows because he's from LA, but the West Coast, there is a hot dog that's on a coffee cocoa blend. I call cocoa butter coffee. From a rabbi in San Francisco, a rabbi in San Francisco, that rabbis are no one can verify who he is. How does one do that? You just cannot find anything about them on the internet. Or is he likely, as rabbis are going to say, sitting on his couch in an island somewhere? Okay, if I send you the name, do you think you could...
If Rabbi Zirkin, we generally don't, listen, we don't evaluate other people's
like, I don't know.
Want to get to the
I just
don't
know if you've heard of
him. With my style.
Hold on, David, do you remember the name of the rabbi on that cocoa coffee thing? The name of the rabbi on that cocoa coffee thing?
He's going to Carvel, a soup Carvel store in like the five towns, and Great Neck have your. Not at the bottom, not at the bottom. But you go to 16 Handles, two stores, some of them have actual certification in the store. You go into a Carvel that just doesn't have the certification in the store. But they claim that all the products are certified.
Right.
Is that satisfactory? I don't know what to say. Again, you know, we generally don't comment about other supervision centers that don't have a supervision. You know, the likelihood it's okay, though I've heard stories, because, you know, they do have a franchise agreement that they're supposed to buy Carvel. Most of the Carvels that do have supervision are under UFK. Carvel actually at one time applied to OU and we didn't grant it to them, but for a different reason, because it's a franchise, so some people sometimes it's a cone, and it'll be certain stores, and then cones and so on, it'll become Chol Hafesa. So we didn't give them supervision. But though I have a Carvel in Englewood, which I love.
Okay, right, but that's under a local supervision now, right?
The one in Englewood, I don't go there anymore. It used to be under the Huff Care. He used to, but now it's actually not. It's no longer a Carvel. It's still a soft ice cream one. It's still under
the Huff Care. So if you're going to simplify my question, if you go into a store, Carvel, it's got certification, not from OU, but Huff Care, whatever it is. But this individual store does not have the supervision that some stores have. Some stores, like in the five towns, they actually say this store is under the supervision of, and somebody actually comes there.
Right, so the Huff K, I wasn't just talking about the product. There are lots of stores, not all of them, you know, that have their supervision. So you asked me about the ones that don't have supervision. You know,
but they claim the products have the supervision.
Right. Oh, well, if you see that it has a Huff K in the product,
right, all Carvel products have a Huff K. However, some stores have the individual rabbi coming.
I'm not sure if that's true that all.
Not in Brooklyn.
Exactly,
yeah.
I don't think that's
so
true.
Check if the vat of ice cream has the Huff K on it and don't get anything else in the store. That's what people do at Baskin Robbins.
Yeah.
So this is a related question. In Brooklyn, there was a soft serve whatever store that posted a sign and it had a picture of an OU. But if you read the fine print, what they were saying is that their products have this hechsher and only some of them. So it was a big to-do in the community, and the rabbis went in there and said, you can't claim to be an OU-supervised store if only some of your products have this, and you can't put this sign in the window. And then the lay people, we started getting involved to go in there and to say, you know, you shouldn't have this sign. Because, of course, I was walking by and I saw some people eating the ice cream. I said, you didn't read the sign carefully. So I called the OU. This is my question. I called them and I said, are you pursuing these people because they're are falsely advertising being a kosher store when they're not a kosher store? And the answer was no. We have no legal claim against them.
Right. So we've looked into some of this. I mean, I'm not sure.
It was on Avenue U. It went out of business.
Right. No, but the one who handles this in my office, his name is Harry Katzenstein. And
I don't remember who I spoke to.
But it's like, and there's another fellow whose name is Bookbinder. He's a lawyer who works for us.
Okay.
So it depends on how they phrase it, whether we can go after them. Because
okay.
if what they say is true, you know, the ingredient that we're using is OU.
Okay.
So it could be misleading, I agree. But
it
legally,
was very misleading.
Right, and it's problematic, but we can't, you know, it depends on the language, and it's a legal issue.
Okay.
I'm going to go now.
Okay, thank you.
One last question. I'm very interested in getting more involved in doing some work with the OU. What kind of opportunities might there be? I have a legal background. But I'm very familiar, as you see, from my question.
Right.
Would there be some opportunity that I might be more likely able to, you know, be involved and work for the OU in some capacity with this type of thing?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if we have an opening right now for something, but do you have a card?
Oh, yeah. No, but I could contact you. Do you have a card or something?
So, you know, you could send me an email. And I'd send it to, you know, some of the people in my office.
Yeah, because I feel I was pretty well, because I have the knowledge, I have a legal background, you know, so I can do a number of different things.
Oh boy, I think I used that microphone. That's what I just see. I don't have it, I'm sorry, but I can...
How long is that going
to take? I can
is the woman
allowed
to roll over in the shop?
Yeah.
You were right, it's Rabbi Trout. Rabbinical Council, San Francisco,
right.
Something, something.
So as I said, I don't comment on different supervisions. It's not one of the stronger ones.
For a coffee, cocoa powder.
Well, it could be okay. I mean, likelihood it is okay, but you know.
You would not have it in your home. We returned it. I'm just asking.
Yeah. You know, we don't comment on other supervisions.
I actually emailed the CRC.
Yeah.
And they emailed me back. There's some kind of chocolate fudge oil. He said that I don't know anything about. So I wouldn't recommend it. That's what his response was.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't say straight out.
This is my email, ganakm@ou.org. So it's...
Joe, that's your name, right?
Right,
at ou.org. All right.
Okay.
Are you related to Ozzy Ganak?
My brother.
That's your brother. He used to run a sports night at...
right,
I used to go to that one. At Young Israel.
Oh, I meant to say Young Israel.
I used to go to that when I was
right.
a kid. I loved
right.
it. Where is he around these days?